Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Listeners, welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast. Today, my guest is Mark Lowther. And the reason Mark's on today is not only is he an amazing hostage negotiation professional that's taught all over the world, it's because he's teaching people hostage negotiation and mediation and dispute resolution techniques in Ukraine, in the middle of a war zone. And we brought him on to talk us through what's happening. What's happening at sort of a boots on the ground level around negotiation in Ukraine right now? And it is a sombering perspective of what is happening. And it's really good to understand what people are going through and what is being done to help in that area. And it's good to maintain that perspective, because it is a very active and dynamic and changing situation with so many variables and so many moving parts that it makes it difficult sometimes to anticipate or understand moves that are being made at higher levels, and then sort of aligning that with the reality of what's happening with boots on the ground. We support Mark and his movement to resolve dispute and teach people how to obviously resolve dispute. That's a big part of why this show exists. And we're very grateful for people like Mark who do the work that they do in the areas that they do it. And we can only hope and pray for resolution in some sort of capacity to help save lives. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Mark Lowther. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
I'm excited to have you back, man. You've been doing some very interesting and important work lately. But before we get into that discussion, maybe tell the listeners a bit about who you are and what you do.
My name is Mark Lowther, and I live in Ogden, Utah, which is about 30 miles north of Salt Lake City. Just began my 31st year in law enforcement, worked 24 years full-time. I continue to work in law enforcement part-time. And for the majority of my time in law enforcement, I specialized in the field of hostage negotiation, crisis intervention, mental health awareness, suicide intervention. So I've kind of gravitated towards the de-escalation communication part of law enforcement before it was the catchphrase, so to speak.
And lately, you've been doing some very interesting work in Ukraine.
Yeah, I just come back from my fifth trip to Ukraine. And if everything goes according to plan, I'll be returning to Ukraine in August.
All right. There are so many things I want to talk about with this. But let me start by asking, why were you there?
I went there with a non-government organization, and I've been there. I've trained military. I've trained law enforcement. I've even trained some of their intelligence people, and I've actually even trained probably the majority of training I've done has actually been with civilians in negotiation, de-escalation, communication, nonviolent communication strategies and techniques.
Amazing. What did you find was the most surprising thing when you entered? First of all, was getting in easy or was it challenging?
The first four times was a piece of cake because I went over before Russia had invaded from the north and went into Kyiv. All my trips have been post-2014 when the invasion of Crimea took place. And so my first four trips over, I actually flew right into Kyiv and drove on into Kyiv. This last trip, however, I had to fly into Poland, and then going in, we took a train from Poland into Kyiv, and that took close to 11 hours. And that was kind of risky. That was probably one of the most nerve-wracking parts of the trip because the rail lines have been targeted. And of course, you know, we're civilians going into Kyiv, but we're also using the same rail lines that troop movements and supplies and weapons and ammunition. So obviously we're in close proximity to strategic targets. So that was kind of a, I mean, there was no incidents, but that was something that we were very aware of going in. And then coming out, we drove out. And of course, the Ukrainians didn't get the joke. But if you're familiar with Mel Gibson's older movie from back in the 80s, Road Warrior, where, you know, gasoline's in short supply and everything. Well, there's not a lot of gasoline over there. It's being rationed. And so when you do find a gas station that has it, that you can only buy 5 liters, which for us Americans is the equivalent of 5 gallons. And so in the vehicle I was in, we had these 5 gallon jugs filled with fuel to make sure that we would have enough fuel to make it back to Poland. And so that was kind of an interesting concept. And then once we actually got to the border of Ukraine and Poland, once we were physically looking at the border, I mean, I was a quarter of a mile from Poland. It took us 6 hours to get from the Ukrainian side to the Polish side. And so that was, you know, that took about as long as the whole trip from Kyiv to the border. And then we still had to go on into Krakow, Poland.
So when you arrived in Ukraine, what did you find as the most surprising aspect of working in essentially a war zone like that?
Well, the first 4 times in Kyiv itself, you would never even know that there was a war going on. But I did leave one of my trips over there. We did travel to the contact zone where the fighting was at. Probably one of the most, I didn't know much about Ukraine until I went there. And one of the interesting dynamics is extreme Eastern Ukraine has a lot of ethnic Russians. And so there's really kind of some mixed feelings. You get in Kyiv and west of Kyiv, and they're Ukraine through and through and through. But there's certain segments, and I'm certainly not speaking for all of the people there, but there's certain segments in Eastern Ukraine who are very sympathetic to Russia, actually only speak Russian and wouldn't mind becoming part of Russia again. So that's actually one of the main reasons I went over there to train civilians, was to try to bring some mediation and dialogue between those who were in Ukraine but weren't necessarily supportive of Ukraine and, of course, the regular Ukrainian citizens themselves. Because, you know, there was a lot of Ukrainian on Ukrainian animosity and even some violence there in Eastern Ukraine. And this is before this latest invasion that started in January. This is post-2014.
Okay, interesting. So in teaching folks how to deal with sort of conflict-based situations using our words and using negotiation techniques, what did you see as the most difficult aspect of that work?
Really, it's really kind of universal. The students that I taught, I wasn't their only instructor. They had been also taught by other individuals from other countries. And one of the main things that I saw and I continue to see is people, I see it when I teach law enforcement officers and I see it when I teach civilians. Yes, I'm teaching negotiation. Yes, I'm teaching communication, nonviolent communication, DS, whatever term you want to apply to it, but don't forget to be a human being. And what I mean by that is a lot of times when these people, they would get real heavy into this active listening and stuff like that, and they sound like robots. They're like, so I hear you are upset today. And I was like, you know, nobody talks like that. You know, have a conversation and put some active listening into it. And one of the things I would explain to them, and I even explain to police officers here in the United States, is when I go through all this active listening and all these techniques that we teach, they should complement your basic communication. Don't sound like a robot when you do this. Don't jam pack so much active listening skills into a sentence, a paragraph, a statement that you sound like a robot or a cyborg. And so kind of the analogy I use is think of active listening as a seasoning. You know, you're cooking a steak or making pasta or whatever your favorite dish is. And if you don't season it a little bit, then it's going to be very, very bland. But if you over season it, then it's going to taste nasty and not be good either. So you're kind of trying to find that right balance. And so, one of the things I'm telling them is sprinkle in a little bit of active listening, but don't jam pack it with so much that you sound like a robot. You don't sound authentic. You don't sound real. You don't even sound like you mean what you say. You just sound like you're reading off of a script to check all the boxes to get active listening in there, if that makes sense.
It does. I'm sure, given the situation, that there were a lot of emotions that were running hot, potentially. And how did you deal with that as a trainer, given the situation?
It's an important to understand both sides, you know, and this is, of course, negotiation 101. But, you know, as I'm training these people, and they're going to be going back to Eastern Ukraine, right? Close. In fact, some of them are crossing the contact line. Some of them are going back to areas occupied by Russian separatists and now Russia. And one of the things that I would tell them is we all have emotions, and nobody, including ourselves, including negotiators, make good decisions when we're very emotional. And so you have to kind of control your own emotions, and you have to take their emotions into account. And, you know, and again, it's negotiation 101, but empathy. Put yourself in their shoes. One of the big things that caused a lot of contention in Eastern Ukraine, and to my knowledge, it never passed, but prior to 2014, there was some legislation to actually outlaw the Russian language in Ukraine, to be just really, really pro-Ukrainian and, you know, trying to really separate themselves from Russia. And you can imagine growing up in your country and Russian language is what you know. It's what you learned as a kid. It's what your parents spoke. It's what your grandparents spoke. It's really all that you know. And now, because of, you know, some legislation wanting to separate themselves from Russia, that they're now going to literally out. Never even heard of outlawing a language before. I'm sure it's probably happened, but I've never heard of it. And so that's one of the things I was telling these individuals that's going back, is I says, imagine that that's their native language. That's the language they know. And now there was talk of forcing them to no longer be able to use, at least legally, the language they grew up speaking. You know, how would that make you feel? You know, how would you feel about that? You know, kind of just the basic empathy thing. And so, you know, it kind of really kind of puts things into perspective as to how some people could be upset at the Ukrainian government, or be upset at least with certain members of the Ukrainian government. And so, you know, it's kind of that old adage, you know, there's two sides to the story. And so, you know, you have to take into their perspective. You know, you have your perspective and their perspective, and somewhere in the middle is probably the true perspective. And you can't forget that. You know, don't barge in there like a bull expecting to change their mind. Walk in there softly, sit down, have a dialogue, and listen to their side, and enlighten and educate yourself before you try, you know, winning hearts and minds.
Were there any cultural nuances that you had to adjust to within your training? Like, did you have to shape or change how you trained things to accommodate a different cultural base?
Well, of course, it wasn't cultural, but the translation thing was huge. You know, it literally takes twice as long to teach anything, at least for me, with a translator over there. And I had very, very good translators. But, you know, stuff, you know, I've taught enough here in the U.S. that, you know, I knew really well, you know, how long it would take to teach active listening, or how long it would take to teach de-escalation or dealing with deadlines or demands or whatever. And when you throw the translation component into it, then that, you know, slowed things down quite a bit. Initially, you know, there's a lot of curiosity about America and stuff like that. Ukrainian people are great, very, very friendly people, very, very respectful, humble people. I did learn, whenever you go into a house over there, I mean, I know a lot of Americans do it as well, but it's a really solid custom over there, is when you go into a house in Ukraine, you take your shoes off no matter what. You know, the food was unique and a little bit different, but, you know, it's a very, very beautiful country, a lot of farmland. And then, of course, Kyiv's home of 4 million people. So you get kind of that real rustic, you know, major European city feel. But then you get 60 miles outside of Kyiv, and you look around, and if you didn't know any better, you could easily envision yourself as being in Nebraska or Kansas when you see all of the farm fields and all the agriculture going on. But, you know, it was pretty straightforward. And like I said, my translators helped me a lot, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of custom issues that I had to really acclimate to.
Folks, we're going to take a short break from this podcast to tell you all about the negotiation training that we offer at Negotiations Ninja. If you're part of a sales team, if you're part of a procurement team, if you're part of a customer service team, really, if you're part of any customer or internal facing organization where communication sometimes fails, we probably have training that's going to help you. If you're trying to figure out how to deal with conflict better, if you're trying to figure out how to get more value out of your negotiations, if you're trying to figure out how to deal with price increases, give me a cold. The easiest way to be able to do that is to go straight to our website at negotiations.ninja. That's negotiations.ninja, or reach out to me directly on LinkedIn and let's set up a conversation. Would love to chat with you all about that. Let's get back to the show. There's a fantastic book by a guy by the name of Igor Rizov called The Kremlin Style of Negotiation. And it talks about Russian negotiation styles. Was that a part of the discussion, or were you able to speak with any sort of local negotiation instructors there who had different views on how things should be done?
I really didn't encounter any other, at least Ukrainian negotiation instructors. Pretty much myself and everyone else that was training over there came from different countries. And in fact, it was kind of interesting when I was training Ukrainian police, you know, the concept of opening a dialogue and of having communications and trying to convince someone to come out was really kind of foreign to them. You know, initially some of the reactions I got is, you know, he's a criminal. He just needs to come out or else, you know, and right. There was none of this, you know, gray area of, hey, let's slow things down and maybe try talking to him a little bit. You know, I would get this. He's a criminal. He needs to come out or else, you know, and I'm like, well, let's try a different way, you know, and now they actually, and I'm not claiming credit for it because it was their own doing, but they actually have what's called dialogue police now. So they actually have a group of Ukrainian police officers who are trained in communication. And they will respond to barricades, threatened suicides, mental illness calls, and hostage situations. And so they call them dialogue police. And I've interacted with and trained with them quite a bit over there. But that's something that's come about, you know, more recently.
Were you in any active situations where you had to coach a team through a negotiation, or was it mainly sort of like outside of active situations?
No, I wasn't in any active situations. I took some of their examples of situations they'd been in, and we would recreate that in a scenario. I had actually, I don't know if you saw it on the news or not, it was a couple of years ago. I'd actually just recently been there and returned back to the U.S. when they had the guy that went on the bus and took several people hostage on the bus there in Ukraine,
right,
and was demanding to speak to the president of Ukraine. He eventually got his wish and then surrendered, of course, was arrested and is now incarcerated. I wasn't there when that happened, but I was there shortly before that.
It's so fascinating to me to think of all of the different areas where in a conflict zone, conflict inevitably obviously pops up in different derivatives. So it may be hostage situations, maybe just verbal conflict. It may be wartime conflict. What was the most prevalent or the most common situation that the Ukraine force is dealing with, the police force that you were training? What was the most prevalent type of conflict they were dealing with? What happened most often?
Well, that would be hard to say because, like I said, in Kyiv, you have the typical big city issues. And then I traveled to the outlying areas and stuff like that. And so in the outlying...
Were you in the east? Were you dealing with folks who may have been Russian separatists?
One of my trips there, I was in the east. I didn't cross the contact line, but I could have thrown a rock across the contact line. I went as far as to be at the last Ukrainian checkpoint. If I would have passed that checkpoint, the next individuals I would have come face to face with would have been Russian separatists. I was that close. We talked about crossing the contact line. I don't want to disclose anybody that I was with because they still work over there. But one of the individuals, you know, several individuals guided me there for me to get there safely and stuff like that. One of the individuals I was with on that trip had actually crossed the contact line and interacted with the separatists. And we talked about doing that. But I was over there, this particular trip over there, I was over there a few weeks after. It was when President Trump was still in office and we had sent a couple missiles into Syria. And there were some Russian casualties involved in that missile attack in Syria. And that was only a couple of weeks prior to me being there. And so as our discussions, that we felt that it might not be go over too well, you know, me being American over there, kind of poking around and stuff like that. So we decided not to do it, but we thought about it. But I went right to the line.
Okay, so given your experience with Russians and Ukrainians, specifically within a negotiation context, especially around sort of the conflict that exists, I have to ask you the big question of, do you think that this issue between Ukraine and Russia can be resolved through negotiation?
I think it can be, but not by those who are currently involved. I think Putin is the big issue, the big stumbling block. I think an international delegation could possibly have some chance at it. It's when you look at the Ukrainian side of things, and I get this, the Ukrainians' view of things is, why are we negotiating? This is our country. They're taking part of our country. So we should negotiate away Crimea, or we should negotiate away a quarter or a third of our country. And they view that as being ridiculous. And I see that side of their argument, but also the other side of the argument is, yes, but will it save lives? Will it save hundreds, if not thousands of lives by stopping the violence now? Will it stop further destruction? Yes, I agree with you totally that, you shouldn't have to negotiate away part of your country. But, when you're losing hundreds, if not thousands of lives on a daily basis, including civilians, including children, is that worth coming to the bargaining table for? And so that's going to be the big challenge because, Ukrainians, understandably so, are very, very proud. And, you being my good friend from Canada, it'd be kind of like if Canada invaded Montana, it would be hard for Americans to say we're going to come to the negotiation table because Montana's ours. Why are we even negotiating? You're taking what's ours. You're taking what belongs to us. And so it becomes kind of that balance of what's best for the situation now versus your pride in basically negotiating away part of your country. So, I don't know how it's going to end up right now. It's very, very dynamic. I hate to say this, and this is no disrespect to I have many, many, many dear friends in Ukraine, but right now I feel that they're slowly losing the battle right now is from what I see and hear is what I'm afraid is happening. They've fought very valiantly and they continue to do so, but I see them slowly, slowly losing their grip. So we'll see. Things would have to change pretty dramatically for it to turn around, but who knows?
I view it, and this is from a completely uneducated sort of outsider's viewpoint, as almost like how a vice squeezes something until it becomes unmanageable for that thing to hold the pressure anymore, and that thing collapses under the pressure of what's happening. At least that's how it appears to me strategically with the way things have been moving from Russia to Ukraine. There must be at some point a decision made by Zelensky and those around him to start conversations. But at the same time, there also needs to your point, to be a willingness on the part of Putin to accept less concessions than he believes he's owed.
Yeah, exactly. Putin's gotten pretty greedy. I mean, he essentially got away with taking Crimea. He essentially got away with that. And there's a lot of politics in that. We could talk for 2 hours about NATO and the European Union and military bases and access to the Black Sea and all kinds of stuff like that. But he essentially got away with that. And now it just appears that he's almost being, if you believe all of the reports that you read, in fact, his own kind of rambling speech that he gave just before the invasion started, it sounds like he's doing a lot of this just because he's nostalgic for the old Soviet Union days. And, and there's a little bit more to that. There's energy issues and access to the Black Sea for shipping energy and other stuff like that. But he seems really, really unrealistic. And, he keeps throwing out the statement that he's willing to talk. But with him, I think his talking part is basically stop fighting and just lay down your arms and let me take what I want. And Ukraine has no interest in that. In fact, I think he thought that that's what was going to happen to begin with. I think that's what happened to him when he tried rolling into Kyiv. I think he thought Zelensky was going to get on an airplane and flee in the middle of the night. I don't think he gave him nearly as much credit as he should have. I think he highly, highly underestimated the resolve of the Ukrainian people because they put up one hell of a fight and essentially pushed his forces back and in many cases were kind of kicking their butt. So now Putin's kind of changed his strategy and probably doing now what he should have been doing all along is he's went to the eastern part where he already has access to the country, where they've had access to the country for 4 or 5 years now. And he's just kind of trying to slowly squeeze and march further north and further north and further north. If he plans on stopping at some point, I don't know. Or if he figures that if he just kind of wears them down long enough, if he'll make another run at Kyiv, I don't know. I do know, or at least I can't say that I know, but I very strongly assume he was hoping that they would just lay down and not fight because he didn't want to destroy Ukraine. He wants to rule Ukraine. So all of those buildings, all those power plants, all that infrastructure that he's destroying with rockets and artillery, it's a big if, but if he does come to rule Ukraine, at some point he's going to have to rebuild. And so I think he's kind of in a rock and a hard spot. The rest of the world is watching, you know, being a dictator in his country, the rest of his country's watching. And for him, I think he truly views that failure is no option. I think that he feels that if he doesn't win on this fight that he started, that he will be overthrown at some point rather quickly. And whether that's true or not, I don't know. I've never claimed to be an expert on Russia, but from what I do know of him and what I've talked to other people, he's really kind of all in on this. At least he views that he's all in. He views any failure in his mission over there will seriously undermine his power, his stronghold in Russia as president. And that makes him very dangerous.
Incredibly. And what's interesting to me is, at least financially and economically, despite significant sanctions, the ruble continues to be very stable and really has been unaffected whatsoever by what's going on. And further to that, he's in a very strong leverage position because he holds all the cards when it comes to natural resources, especially around oil and gas in and around Europe. So he controls to a large degree some significant assets and some significant leverage to quote unquote win over other European countries to facilitate at least more concessions from Ukraine to Russia. At least that's how it appears to me in the long term. Because if he flexes, and I would assume that he would come winter, then that facilitates a difficult situation for many other European countries because now they're at risk.
Yeah, exactly. He has a lot of strategy with the energy that he provides countries, especially Germany, but certainly other countries as well. The other shoe that hasn't dropped yet, but you're hearing more and more of it in the media now, is, you know, Ukraine's one of the biggest, in fact, in Europe, it's the largest supplier in Europe, if I'm correct. And in the world, they're one of the biggest suppliers in the world of, you know, wheat, grain, and of course, sunflower oil. But now that all the ports are being closed to the Black Sea, yeah, there's still rail lines going into Poland, as long as they still continue to be open and exist. But, you know, it's a lot easier to load cargo ships in the Black Sea and ship it around the world than it is to haul it by train out of Ukraine to Poland by rail. And you're just one rocket strike away from shutting that down for days, if not weeks. And so how is the rest of the world going to react if that food supply starts getting choked off? Will that put pressure on Zelensky to concede, or will that put pressure on Putin to back off, or will that put pressure on the rest of the world to take a more active role in this conflict? You know, I think that's still the other dynamic that really hasn't hit yet that's coming down the pipe.
Yeah, it's such a dynamic and ever-changing situation. Now, when are you planning on going back?
If everything goes as planned, I'll be going back the last half of August.
Well, Godspeed, my friend. It's a fascinating conversation. We'd love to have you back on to talk more about it and to talk more through the work that you're doing there as well. You've got such a unique opportunity and perspective because of your work in general, and then also the work that you're doing with the Ukrainian people. I hope that, and given your expertise and your knowledge, I know that you'll be able to help a lot of people in the process, but I hope and I pray that your work is full of safety and that you come back to us safe and sound to share more news.
I appreciate that. And I would just like to, if you allow me, just one final statement. Probably one of the biggest things that the Ukrainians are the most emphatic about is almost every Ukrainian I met, and it was a constant question of, you know, is the rest of the world watching what's happening here? And initially we were. The big thing that I want to stress to everyone is don't let Ukraine become a news cycle that fades away. What's happening there today, what's happening there right now is the same thing that was happening there 2-3 months ago. don't let a news cycle let you forget about what's happening over there, because it is a humanitarian crisis. There are people that are being dislodged from their homes, that are fleeing by the hundreds to neighboring countries as refugees. Brothers, fathers, husbands are fighting or being killed. Don't forget Ukraine. Don't let your, you know, whatever state you're from, country you're from, government you represent or involved with, please, we need to keep the attention on Ukraine. We can't just let what's happening over there become a news cycle that kind of fades away and becomes forgotten. That's probably one of the things they fear the most, is that the rest of the world is going to stop caring and forget about them and the fight that they're involved in, because they truly are fighting for their lives right now.
Yeah. And I appreciate those words and that sentiment. Mark, thank you so much for being here today. For the listeners, just so that you know, I want you to keep following what Mark's doing, because occasionally he'll post the odd photo every now and again on LinkedIn about some of the work that he's doing in Ukraine and some of the people that he's working with. And it's good to sort of keep an ear to the ground of what's going on at sort of the boots level, the things that are happening with real people at real time. So again, Mark, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Mark.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get, because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.